Well, it is certainly good to be here this morning and appreciate the presence of all. It is always good to be back after having been away for a week. And I want to invite you to open your Bibles to John, the 7th chapter. Our primary text today will be Luke 23, and we'll come to that in just a moment. But in John, the 7th chapter, in verse 30, we read, "Therefore they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come." And in the 8th chapter, in verse 20, you got a very similar statement. "These words Jesus spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him, for his hour had not yet come." As we have been noting, Jesus came into this world to die for our sins, to be that lamb that would take away the sins of the world. But he was not going to be killed on man's timetable. It would be when the right time had come. In Luke, the 22nd chapter, remember that Jesus is in the garden and one of the 12, Judas, has come to betray him. And on various occasions before, Jesus had walked away. But this time, he allows himself to be arrested. Look at verse 52. "Then Jesus said to the chief priests, captains of the temple, and the elders who had come out to him, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me.'" You know, the idea is, I was right there in the midst of you all this time, and nobody tried to grab me then. Why are you acting like I'm some dangerous criminal? You acting like I'm a robber. Then he adds, "But this is your hour and the power of darkness." The time had come when the world would be allowed to have, when Satan would be allowed to have his temporary triumph over Jesus. The hour had come when Jesus would go to the cross, when he would die as God had appointed. And I want us to look at the 23rd chapter today. Lord willing, we will look at a portion of it this morning and the rest of it this evening. Just to remind us, the sufferings of Jesus have begun in the 22nd chapter as he is denied by his friend Peter, deserted by the others, betrayed by Judas. He's treated like, as he just said, a common criminal. Through the night, he's been mocked. He's been spat upon. He's been beaten. He's been through these phony trials. Now in the 23rd chapter, we have the Jewish council brings him before Pilate, the Roman governor. At this time, the Jews did not have the right to execute a criminal. They could request it, but they couldn't carry it out. They bring him before Pilate. Pilate thinks he's found an out when he realizes that Jesus is from Galilee. And Herod was the ruler over Galilee, Herod Antipas, the same one that had killed John the Baptist. And he sends him over to Herod, hoping to just dump it in his lap. Well, Herod doesn't find any fault in him. They mock him, make fun of him. But he sends him back to Pilate. And then what we have beginning at verse 13 is Pilate says again, "Look, the guy's done nothing wrong. He certainly does not deserve death." Pilate, well, the Roman government, had a custom that at the Passover they would release a prisoner. Pilate, he thinks he's smart, and he gives them a choice between Barabbas, a murderer, and Jesus. But the people cry out and say, "Release Barabbas and crucify Jesus." So they take Jesus, verse 26, and they lead him out, and a man named Simon, a Cyrenian, was forced to bear the cross. Putting it all together, it would appear that at least Jesus bore the cross part of the way, or what was happening was Simon was merely having to help him because the load was too much. He has an exchange with the women of Jerusalem that we'll talk about later, but they let him out and they crucified him outside the city in a place called Golgotha, the place of the skull, Calvary. And Pilate took, we might just say, one last shot at the Jews when he put a title up over the head of Jesus that said, "This is the King of the Jews." You wanted this man crucified? Well, I'm going to say, you've killed your king. And after several hours on the cross, about six, Jesus perishes and is buried in the tomb of Joseph. My intent today is not to go through each paragraph, each verse in detail. These are, I hope, familiar stories, but there's some lessons I would like to pull from this. In fact, this morning I have four that I think ought to be things that we think about. When I think about Jesus, one of the things that stands out to me, and I've made some allusion to this already, but it's how that fame is fleeting. Think about how that Jesus, less than a week before this, comes into Jerusalem, and we have termed it now the triumphal entry. And it's just hard for us to picture this arrival in Jerusalem as people are cutting branches off of trees. Some of them are pulling off their own clothes to lay in the street. And they are shouting, "Hosanna to the Son of David." And I mean, they give him, we call it the red carpet treatment. And just such a wondrous welcome. And then what's made clear is Luke, maybe in his account, doesn't make it as clear as Matthew. But it is the multitudes that are shouting, "Crucify him." The chief priests and the elders are able to work up the crowd to turn against Jesus. And I think about, we seek fame, popularity. We want to be accepted by those around us. How do you achieve these kinds of things? Sometimes, as Galatians 1 and verse 10 says, it takes a willingness to compromise one's convictions. Paul would say, verse 10, "For do I now persuade men or God, or do I seek to please men? For if I still pleased men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ." To really be popular, to be famous, to just be accepted in general, you've got to give people something they like. And oftentimes that's going to involve compromise. I mean, sometimes preachers will begin to compromise convictions because they realize that there's a path to greater fame. Or if they don't compromise and change what they preach, well, they do change what they preach. They may not preach anything false, but they begin to preach in such a way as nobody would ever possibly be offended. They style their preaching so that it appeals to people. And it can all be true, but it's not really designed to first please God. I will say this. I've seen some preachers that maybe go in the other direction. They realize there is an element that likes kind of the attack dog kind of preaching. And all theirs is negative because they want to appeal to that element. But I think all of us have that temptation. We've all heard the old saying, the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. We want to fit in. And so we begin to say things, do things. Our dress, instead of first being concerned about being modest, you know, pure, we think about how will others see it. You know, we begin to make our language where it's more like that of those around us. There are people that they just become uncomfortable with New Testament doctrine. The way of the New Testament is a narrow way. Jesus said that. We live in a world that demands we be accepting of everybody and everything. And we have to be careful. Now, I want to go back to something I said a moment ago. So often to achieve fame, popularity, acceptance, we have to compromise our conviction. But now Jesus achieved fame without doing that. Sometimes it can come to us, but rarely as if ever is it retained without at some point compromising. And I want to challenge us. Don't go pursuing something that's not going to last. Just a little brief illustration. Sometimes on Sunday mornings when I'm coming here early to do the bulletin, I will listen to a portion of it. My drive's short enough. I'm thankful for that. But, you know, I listen to a little bit of the 70s on 7. And at 8 o'clock, they replay a countdown of Casey Kasem's top 40 from some week in the 1970s. And I lived during the 70s. You know, I was a very young person in the 70s. But no. I am amazed at some of the songs and the artists that pop up on that. People that you go, I mean, there are those people you hear and you go, yeah, this morning heard a little bit of Gladys Knight. I mean, she had a long period. Most of these one-hit wonders, Brownsville Station, you know, I dare you to name more than one song those guys did. You know, that it's Black Oak, Arkansas. Who? Don't go after something that's not going to last anyway, so that you compromise your stand for truth. Consider again, Matthew 5:16 challenges us to let our light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. The challenge is to be the best person we can be. To be the best possible influence we can be. To love our neighbor as ourself. To let our light shine. And we want people to glorify God because of us. And yet, realize, if we are not careful, we become more worried about whether people are noticing our lights than whether we are causing people to glorify God. And I think that's where the pursuit of fame and acceptance becomes a stumbling block. As I'm beginning to worry, are people noticing me? Are people seeing me? And I begin to pursue that. Let me go back to Luke 23, and I want you to notice something about Herod. Luke is the only writer that tells us about Pilate sending Jesus over to Herod. Look at verse 6. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Here's Pilate like, wow, this is my day. I've been wanting to see this Jesus. I've heard he can do some miracles. Maybe he'll do a miracle for me. Back in chapter 9 of Luke, we were told something there about Herod. When Herod had heard about all that Jesus was doing, he says, you know, he's hearing that some people are saying, verse 7, John is risen from the dead. By some that Elijah had appeared. By others that one of the old prophets had risen again. Herod said, John I have beheaded, but who is this of whom I hear such things? So he sought to see him. He's been wanting to see Jesus for some time. Was John interested in letting Jesus teach him? Mark makes a point that Herod listened to John the Baptist on more than one occasion. But Herod never changed his life. He had taken his brother's wife. He was a cruel, wicked man. He was curious about Jesus. He was interested in seeing this man. And in fact, he was hoping Jesus would put on a show for him. And I don't mean to suggest that anything today is exactly parallel to that. But I believe there are a lot of people that find they've got a curiosity about Jesus, about the Bible. They want to know things about the Bible. In fact, there are people, they'll get into heated Bible arguments with you. Debate passages. Debate various things. But they have no real interest in doing anything about it. And what we've created is a culture that, religiously speaking, it puts Jesus on display as an entertainer, not as a prophet, not as an authoritative. I mean, the modern church, particularly the modern community church, the Hillsides, the whatever the one that's called that just moved into Madison, you know, that, you know, these are epic. These are things that are entertaining to people. You know, we have choreographed shows, you know, our praise band, and, you know, the message is designed. It'll make us feel good. It might challenge us to be a better one who loves his neighbor. But the nitty gritty of biblical morality, of biblical worship, these are not things we're about. In James, the first chapter, notice this is James writing to Christians. He cautions that we must be doers of the word, not hearers only. He said, deceiving ourselves. Sometimes it's easy to get caught up in the stories of the Bible. And going through the Old Testament right now in our classes, there are some fascinating stories. They're exciting. They're great history. You know, some of the poetry of the Psalms, it is just beautiful. And there are a lot of things, you know, there are passages that challenge us to, you know, we can, shall we say, argue about. But the key is it changing our lives? You know, I need to honestly reflect on myself and say, what's this church thing doing for me? You know, am I coming here and being made better? Or am I coming here to enjoy the singing? You know, to hear preaching, to be, you know, to associate with others. Am I being changed by it? Herod was not changed by his encounters with John. He was not at all changed by his encounter with Jesus. Because Herod wasn't looking for truth. Herod was looking for a show. And that attitude hasn't disappeared from our culture. I suspect, while those are the two lessons you may not really have thought about, this third one would have stood out to you. Hypocrisy abounds in this chapter. Hypocrisy is everywhere. It starts, of course, with Herod. I mean, not Herod, with Pilate. Herod, maybe to some degree, but here is Pilate. And you start at verse 13, And after Pilate has already said in verse 4, I find no fault in this man, he doesn't release him. He sends him to Herod. He gets him back. And he tells him in verse 14, I've examined this man, and I find no fault in him. Verse 15, neither did Herod. Then you get the first little sign. Well, I'd say the first sign was he says he's innocent, but I'm going to send him over to Herod. Maybe Herod can try him. But the next one is when he says he's really innocent, so I will chastise him and release him. Well, if he's innocent, why would you chastise him? You know, you are the governor in charge of justice. What's just about that? But Pilate goes on, and they keep shouting, crucify him. Verse 22, why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and of the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested. And he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. It is pure hypocrisy to call yourself the judge of the people and to willingly sign the death warrant of an innocent man. But look at the rulers of the Jews. Look at them. They said in verse 2, they have led him to Pilate, verse 1, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. They bring Jesus before Pilate because, oh, we are so concerned about this man's committing treason. He's not loyal to Caesar. And then, what do they say about Barabbas? A man who had committed murder in a rebellion against the government. Oh, release him. You know, we're very content to let a convicted rebel go free. It is hypocrisy on their part. Jesus was not disloyal to Caesar. They had no concerns about that. You know, they said that, you know, they wanted him to be killed. 1 Peter 2, 1. We know 1 Peter 2 and verse 2, desire the pure milk of the word. What does he say preceding that? Lay aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy. Get rid of the hypocrisy. So many warnings about that in the New Testament. Look at Galatians, the second chapter. Paul, and this is a fascinating story, says, now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy. To study the origins of hypocrisy in the Greek language are fascinating. It was once used of the actors and the mask they wore on stage, that in old Greek plays, sometimes people played more than one role. They just go off stage, put on a different mask, and come back out, be somebody else. You know, and so you can see where that came to be used of people who, as it were, put on a mask. Here are Peter and Barnabas. Before the Gentiles, they have the mask of acceptance and love. But here come some brethren up from Judah. Oh, no, they put on the mask of Jewish exclusiveness. And, you know, we're just like you guys. Here's the fact. 1 John 1 makes it clear. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. That's 1 John 1:8. There's not a one of us that doesn't stumble from time to time. Hypocrisy is not the fact that sometimes we mess up. Hypocrisy is not found in the fact that, yes, we're not perfect. But hypocrisy is found in those who, they're just different people on Monday than they are on Sunday. Yeah, we do different things on Sunday than we do on Monday. Monday we get up and go to school, go to work. But I tell you, the person that goes to work on Monday ought to be the same person that got up Sunday morning and went to worship. We ought to be the same people. You know, we're like Paul or like Peter and Barnabas. We're nice to certain people at certain times, but when no one's looking or somebody else is looking, we become a different person. You know, I look about hypocrisy. There are a lot of things that go into that. Here in this chapter, one of the reasons why some people are hypocrites is brought out. And that's cowardice. I suspect when people think of Pilate, coward is probably one of the words that comes to their mind. You know, here is a man charged with justice, and he commits a great act of injustice, knowing it's an act of injustice. But why? He feared the people. He had a position of power. He did not want to lose that position of power. And he was afraid of the people. Why did Peter and Barnabas, why did they act the way they did at Antioch? They both knew better. They knew it was wrong. They feared what others would say about them. Sometimes, that's the problem. We get too worried about pleasing men and not pleasing God. We don't have the courage of a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I love 2 Timothy 1. Paul speaks of Onesiphorus. And he speaks of him in the context, verse 15, all those in Asia have turned away from me. And he says, in verse 16, the Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chain. But when he arrived in Rome, he sought me out very zealously and found me. It would have been very easy, and I suspect that's what these people of Asia were doing. We love old Paul. Paul did so much for us, but I don't really want to be associated with, I don't want people to think I'm with this criminal. This man's going to be put to death. And if I'm seen as the friend of this man who'll be put to death, well, where does that put me? Doesn't that make me look bad? And so therefore, they pull away from him. Sometimes, we can do things like that. We see people that deserve our support. Maybe they've taken some stand that's unpopular. But it's unpopular. So therefore, what we do is we tell them, you know, we're behind you. And as, you know, as the saying is, you know, it takes binoculars for them to turn around and find us. We're so far behind them. We play the hypocrite. Because of our cowardice. Let's not be like him. Who are we trying to please? One final one this morning. Look at Luke 23 as Pilate has given in to them, has sentenced Jesus to death, and they are leading him out to the place of crucifixion, to Calvary.
And it says in verse 27, a great multitude of the people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed, the days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore, and breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? Again, this is a story unique to Luke's account. These women he turns to in verse 27. He says, daughters of Jerusalem. A couple of times in this chapter, he will make reference to women who had followed from Galilee. Women who had at times financially supported him, chapter 8. Women who were loyal to him to the end. Who were preparing to come back on Monday to anoint his, I'm on Sunday to anoint his body. That's not who he's speaking to. These are women of Jerusalem. And he says to them, you know, save your tears for yourselves, for your children, for your city. Remember the 21st chapter? He had spoken of the coming destruction of Jerusalem. And that's what he's referencing again here. But I am struck by the fact that here is one who has been up all night through these phony trials, who has been spat upon, humiliated, who has been just brutally scourged, taking the moment to show concern, to sound one more warning to them. He didn't have to say a word. But he says, be concerned for yourself. This is one more warning to Jerusalem. Would I have stopped and done that? What I think sometimes happens with us, and maybe I'm only speaking for myself, I can have great concern for others until I have my own problems. And once I have my own problems and my own situations to deal with, they trump your needs. You know, don't bother me when I've got my problems. You know, and we understand sometimes there's a situation, you're down with the flu. Well, nobody expects you to come over and, you know, help them with their problems at that moment. They would rather you stay away. But I want us to see Jesus. That here he is, after all he's been through, knowing where he's going, knowing what's about to happen, pausing to give this one last warning. Uses the words of Hosea when he spoke of the destruction of Samaria. And he says, you're going to be saying the same words. I read in Philippians, the second chapter, of how that I ought to let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, I ought to esteem others better than myself. I ought to be looking out not only for my own interest, but also for the interest of others. And I'm wondering, where is the exception, the exemption that says, John, don't worry about any of that when problems come on you. When you've got issues that you've got to deal with and problems, don't worry about other people then. You just focus on yourself. And yes, we have to take care of our problems. We have to deal with them. But I fear that sometimes I and others, we get so caught up in our own problems that we fail to be like Jesus. Be concerned for others, no matter how bad it is in our lives. Be a servant. That's what we've seen in Jesus. He was a servant to the very end. What do we learn from this chapter? Well, I hope we learn to be people that seek to please the Lord. Not seeking men, not seeking fame, not having a cowardice that results in hypocrisy. I hope we live the things we've learned. In 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, in verse 14 beginning, "For the love of Christ compels us, because we judge thus, that if one died for all, then all died. And he died for all, that those who live should live no longer for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again." Lord willing, this evening we'll talk more about that death. This morning our brother Coulter has reminded us what an awful, painful death that was. Let's live for the one who died for us. Have you begun to do that and fallen away? Turn back to him. Somewhere along the way, maybe we began to drift from our focus on Jesus. Come back to him. If you've never, ever let that story move you to the point of turning your life to him, no better day than right now. Why don't you come to Jesus? Be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. If we can help you, come as we stand and sing together.